That's one of the daughters of the family in the group.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What if they've been friends for 10 years and they vacation together? And what if one of the parents is a leader in the church, either on staff or a children's ministry director or a deacon or an elder or a pastor? I mean, it
very
gets complicated so quickly. So that was that's sort of the gist of, you know, some of that.
All right, guys. Well, welcome back to the Genesis of Shame podcast. I am here with Mr. Vince Hinders, and we are going to talk about a very important topic that has not been discussed in the church often. I think you guys will really appreciate it. A lot of you guys have young children, have families, are in the church, are heavily involved in the church. Some of you guys are planning to have families. And I think discussing this topic of shame in the context of church, and today we're talking about child-on-child sexual abuse. And I know it's a very sensitive topic. I know it's a difficult topic. Vince has written a dissertation on this topic, so I thought he'd be perfect for this discussion, and I hope you guys benefit from it as well. And Vince, welcome to the show.
It's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Vince, just before we start, I think the audience will want to know just a little bit more about you. I know I discussed about your dissertation and your experience with that, but just to give the audience some background, give us some information about you and you know, where you are in life right now and so on.
Yeah. So I'm a local DC native. I was actually born in Washington, grew up there till I was 9, and then moved across the river to McLean. Currently, I'm married. I have been married for 29 years, awesome. Coming up on 30 this year. I've got 4 adult children, 3 girls and a boy. Mm-hmm. And they're just a delight. I've served here in this church for almost 24 years. Wow. I didn't become a Christian until I was 25. Then I went and served overseas with World Vision for 3 years in Romania, working in orphanages and things like that. Mm-hmm. Met my wife over there. We adopted our daughter over there. We had a child. Awesome. So everything kind of went quickly along those lines. So I've had the joy of being on staff here since about 1997.
Wow.
So, and I'm the executive pastor here, so I get involved in a lot of different things, but that's a little bit of my background.
That's great. And that's very admirable too, because I know that the burnout rate or the new rate of pastors staying in their churches is about 3 to 5 years, I think. And then they move on to other churches or try to establish something else. But to be there for that long, you know, we thank you for that. It's very much needed in the church today.
It's a blessing. You know, we've got a wonderful church and a great team of elders, both staff and non-staff, that really make caring for one another a priority. Mm. And it really helps you stay in there, because pastoring can be kind of hard sometimes.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, thank you again, sir, for being here today. Obviously, as we mentioned to the audience, we have a very difficult topic that we're discussing. Yeah. And I don't know how ready everyone is, but I think as we kind of move through this, just to prepare the audience, guys, it will be a difficult topic. Vince has shared that, you know, we can basically go anywhere with this discussion. And I think that's necessary, you know, even from a counseling perspective, just going to those deep areas of exploring these things. And hopefully it's a blessing to you, obviously coming to it from a biblical standpoint. And I think just to kind of open up the conversation, Vince, it's the question that came up to me right when we started talking about this is, you know, what led you to do your dissertation on this topic?
It's a great question, because it's not the title of my dissertation is Child on Child Sexual Abuse, Responding in the Context of the Local Church. And that's not a common topic that people cover. So, yeah, how did I get there? I began my theological studies at Reformed Theological Seminary in September of 2012, and that's an important date because the next month, in October of 2012, I was named in a civil class action lawsuit related to child abuse reporting related to our church. Mm. And it involved events that primarily occurred in the mid to late 90s, 10 or 15 years prior to this. It wasn't even current things that had gone on. But I was on staff at the time. I was actually new on staff when these things first happened and were alleged. And so it was a civil suit, not a criminal suit. So we were never charged with wrongdoing from a harming children perspective. But clearly, they the people who sued us made allegations that we mishandled the reporting of these situations. And probably most grievously, that that we didn't care for them very well.
Wow.
That's hard. You know, it's a hard thing. In my 24 years of pastoral ministry, I can tell you dealing with child on child abuse in the context of the church, I think has been the most difficult and complex issues. The lines are just not as clear as they are. Say, for instance, in adult abuse of a child, it's very clear what happened. But if you have 2 7-year-olds who conduct themselves in behavior that's not appropriate, is it a crime? Is it like, how do you navigate these waters? And what if it's an older child and a younger child? What if it's children of the same sex? And what if people, I mean, it's just a lot of different things that go on. So your question was, how did I pick this topic? So it was something that was, that came to me in terms of being involved in this situation. But even back in those days when these situations first occurred, it was significant to me that there was no clear guidance given to churches on how to handle these situations. And so in carrying this over all these years, certainly grieved that we made mistakes in how we cared for these families, especially the victims' families. You know, that's hard. I mean, these kids, they went through a lot and their families went through a lot. And at times we didn't always care for them. It wasn't from a lack of trying or a desire to help, but some of the things we did were unwise. Some of the things we did were unhelpful. Like I say, there was no data out there. I've asked pastors, lawyers, police officers, counselors, grief counselors, is there anything out there for how churches should handle this in the context of a church? And nobody's been able to come up with anything. And so even going into seminary, I thought, okay, I knew I had a dissertation coming along the way. And I thought, okay, over these next several years, I'm going to research this. I'm going to look into this and see if I can't at least help the conversation so that in the future, other churches would at least have some resources to think about this that might be helpful.
Vince, I don't know if this is something that you'd be able to share or not, but I think, you know, one of the things that we, where we often learn from is from either our own mistakes or the mistakes maybe that other people made. Are there any, is there anything that you would be able to share where you could say, you know, we did this wrong. Yeah, here's what we did that wasn't helpful.
Yeah. Well, some of the things we did right, or we did try to be actively involved.
Okay.
And so that was helpful. I think that helped for a while, but our lack of training in this area, like if you go to seminary, you don't take classes on this. Nobody teaches you how to do this. People don't specialize in this typically, unless they have a very specific counseling degree, you know, type of emphasis. Where we fundamentally made the biggest mistake, and as we've talked to the victims and their families and people involved, when people sin against each other in the context of a church, the normal operating mindset is reconciliation. People confess sin and there's forgiveness and there's reconciliation. And so if you're familiar with the book, The Peacemaker, for instance, that talks about how people are reconciled in conflict situations, we applied a reconciliation model to this situation that actually needed to be much more carefully handled with regards to victims and perpetrators. These were children. They had suffered abuse. And before you get to reconciliation, there's so much other stuff you have to do in helping victims understand what's happened to them and getting the right counselors around them and the right professionals to assist them and come alongside them. But we had a paradigm, a model of reconciliation, especially because a lot of times the children were very young. So you're primarily dealing with the parents who were typically friends because things happened not in the context of the church. It happened in people's homes. It happened in the basement of somebody's house when the parents were upstairs and the children were downstairs. And so the paradigm, so how do you deal with these families? Well, we're like, well, these families love each other. Obviously there's sin involved, but so let's help them get reconciled. And we missed it by a country mile with regards to the care that has to be taken, really to navigate what those parents were going through, like the parents mm-hmm. of a victim. And how do they make sense of this? The guilt, the shame, like, how could this have happened? Why mm-hmm. did this happen? Who do I blame? Do I blame myself? Do I blame wow. the other family? Do I blame the kids? Like, and these are legitimate, real questions that people have to work through. And we did not have the paradigm of looking at it from that perspective first. It wasn't until later when we realized and read a lot more and studied and asked people like Paul Tripp and others, like, hey, like, what do you do here? And he said, well, you got to be really careful, especially with focusing on the victims and their families. Now, yeah. not to exclude the perpetrators too, but so that's probably the biggest thing is we didn't even have the right paradigm for how to think about how to care for people in that context.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Does that answer your question? Is that?
Oh yeah, that's perfect. I think, you know, you're right because of the various layers that it has, because you're not just working with the children, you're working with the parents. How much of what the children did was intentional? How much of it was with malice? How much, you know, there's all these, so many layers that, where did that idea come from? Right. Exactly. So you have all these things that are happening at once.
Is there other abuse going on in the home? What are the parents' backgrounds? What are the siblings' backgrounds? Have any of the siblings engaged in any of this kind of behavior before? Have the children who perpetrated been victims?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
This is just a lot of different things that go on. And we didn't understand how nuanced and how layered and complex the situations were.
Mm-hmm. You know, and honestly, I'm really surprised that there was nothing out there, you know, but, you know, one thing to say, I guess, to that point is that I think people are starting to feel more confident or at least more receptive to opening up about that, you know, because it's been one of those things that you don't want to stain the church. You know, the church is the bride of Christ. And when these things happen, it kind of leaves that really dark stain on the church. And people are saying, well, why is this happening in the church? More is kind of expected from us as believers. And when this thing happens, the shame is multiplied times 10, right? Because we feel as Christians, we should have a better hold of this. And I think maybe that was experienced even for those people who are trying to resolve it. You know, I don't know if you experienced this afterwards, but maybe there's, gosh, I should have done something different. I know with working with clients, sometimes you look back and you're like, ah, should I have tried this? Should I have tried that? So I know it can be very, very difficult to approach such a sensitive topic like this.
Yeah, and I'm really glad that you highlighted that, because I think by God's grace, there really has been a very healthy change mm-hmm. in our culture since the 1990s and before mm-hmm. In how people even viewed this. I mean, there was so much stigmatism, you know, being ascribed to situations like this, that I'm just so grateful that people can talk about it openly and honestly in ways that they used to not be able to talk about it. And I think, by God's grace, again, I think churches are more humble now to say, listen, if it's happening out in the world, it's happening in your church too.
Well, what were some of the challenges that you found mostly with the parents? Because I know that that's probably a hard thing for a parent to accept. You know, I have two boys. I have another one on the way. They're 4 and 2. You know, it almost makes one feel awkward to say, you know, hey, I don't want you being around certain people at these certain times or these certain places. But at the same time, we also want to protect our children. And we also understand that we are not going to be there all of the time. So there's all these layers. And I don't know if there's a perfect answer for that. But what did you find that the parents struggled with the most?
Yeah, I think for both sets of parents in pretty much every situation I've seen, and I haven't seen that many, but enough mm-hmm. representative sample, there's such a deep sadness and sorrow. It goes on. And depending on what happened and where it happened and who it happened with, there can be different, everything from how did I let this happen? Mm-hmm. I should have known better. I knew that kid, you know, had problems, but why did I let them be alone with my child? Or how could I be so naive to think that it couldn't happen to us? I mean, so the blame, the guilt, the shame that the parents can heap on themselves, that's one side of it. Another very significant side of it is just dealing with the anger. This was wrong. And they're right. But what do you do with that anger? Where does that anger get channeled? How does God help you deal with the anger righteously and redemptively? So those are two big things, shame, anger. And then there's the whole, just the complexities of navigating it of, so who knows about what happened? Mm-hmm. Do you, if it's two families in the same community group, do the other members of the community group get brought in? Is it only leaders in the church who know about what's going on? What about youth ministers or children's ministry leaders or class teachers? Or so, and then you're just trying to navigate all this kind of stuff. And so helping the parents deal with all that, then you add another layer. If a crime has been committed, now you're dealing with lawyers, you're dealing with psychologists, psychiatrists. How do we navigate this, especially the court system? The court system is very adversarial. Mm. And so here you've got potentially these two friends and their children have gotten involved in child-on-child sexual abuse, and there's a victim's family and a perpetrator's family, and now they're in a court setting. Mm-hmm. When has that ever happened? So navigating through an adversarial by design court system, that's really tough. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How do we maintain our friendships? How do we, and then if we're friends with the same people, who gets to be friends with them moving forward? Who gets to stay in the church? Do you need to ask one family to leave because of the nature of what happened and it's just too much pain for the victim's family? Do you ask the perpetrator's family to leave? Those would just be a few.
Yeah. No, and I mean, just thinking about it, you know, like I said, like we talked about at the beginning, just how tough it is to hear these things, because these things are going to be a reality for a lot of people. You know, I think I was, as I was seeing the statistics that you had listed, I mean, I think you had ages as low as 5 and 6. Is that true? And then as high as maybe 12 or 13 of these things happening.
Well, let me run through it. And actually, yeah, children of any age can be abused. And the stats are hard to come by because a lot of people don't report. This is a very, very, very underreported situation. Mm-hmm. The University of New Hampshire has a Crimes Against Children Research Center, and they've actually produced a lot of stuff. But even then, sometimes the data is dated. But even government data is hard to come by. So the Centers for Disease Control say that 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys are sexually abused before the age of 18.
Yeah.
So if you look in your children's ministry classroom, when we get back to being together, just start counting every fourth girl and say, before she turns 18, something is going to happen to her where there's a sexual abuse situation. Mm-hmm. Boys. And so people say, well, who's doing the abusing? And oftentimes, I think in a Christian culture, we think that it's the strangers that are doing it. It's right. The people out there that are doing it. Mm-hmm. And yet almost 90% of all child sexual abuse victims know their abuser. Mm-hmm. This is not stranger danger, not that that can't occur, but that's not where we have to have our guard up. It's around the people that we actually know. Mm-hmm. And so 30% of sexual abuse perpetrators are family members. Okay, so it could be a sibling.
What was that, 30%?
30%. Mm-hmm. That was a Department of Justice statistic. So 30%, and this includes immediate and extended family members, such as parents, siblings, uncles mm-hmm. and aunts, cousins, grandparents. So this is happening in people's homes. It's happening on family vacations. It's happening in the context of family reunions and things like that. But here's the thing that really startled me when I did my research. It says approximately 36% of reported child abuse cases are perpetrated by other children. I just don't think anybody has even a handle on that, that a mm-hmm. third of the child abuse that occurs for 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys is actually perpetrated by another child. And if these kids are in the same youth group, they're in the same church, the families are in the same community group, and the children are meeting downstairs while the parents are upstairs, or they're outside playing in the fort or playing in the yard, and there's no supervision, the red light should be going on. It's going, hey, wait a minute. Let's think about this based on the facts.
Right.
These kids do stuff that are inappropriate. Ages 12 to 14 are the peak sort of for child offenders. So that's a pretty significant thing, but children get abused at all ages. Mm.
Were you able to see the effects of those children who experienced the child abuse? Like, you know, because if they stayed in the church or maybe saw them from afar at some point, were there any consequences that you were able to see, or maybe even in your research that that showed the long-term effects of that abuse on that child?
Yeah, there's quite a bit of research out there on the effects of abuse, because whether it was child on child or whether it was an adult to a child, the effects are fairly well documented. The struggle with issues related to identity, mm-hmm. safety, security are all real and prevalent. So anything that's in that category. So there's a high incidence rate of the children doing drugs, alcohol, experimenting sexually way before they should be doing any of that kind of stuff. Mm. All of those stats go off the charts for children that have been abused, especially at the younger ages where they're not as cognizant of what's going on, and there's trust issues. There's that, I thought this was safe. I thought this was grandpa. Like,
right. Yeah.
Oh, oh yeah. And so those types of things that I think anybody who experiences abuse, but even more so when it's done as a child, and they mm-hmm. don't understand what's happening.
Right. And do they describe the difference? Cause I've seen some of the literature where it talks about the difference between like exploration that they're doing and also actual abuse, you know. So some of the literature seems to cite it as exploration, and I don't know if that's the right term for it or that that's the way that it should be projected, but it seems to be also this other aspect of at what point does someone label that abuse. Is it when people find out? Do the children say something about it? Right, that's the other thing. And I know we're going to get to that in a little bit about, you know, what can parents do, but at what point does it become abuse?
Exactly. And that's part of the problem. And that's why pastors, churches, church leaders, parents should not be making these decisions and evaluations in a vacuum. We need multidisciplinary teams because not everybody agrees. If you got a police officer, a social worker, a child psychologist, a pastor, and two parents in the room, you still might not get agreement on what actually happened and how it should be labeled.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for instance, like if you go to most jurisdictions in the police departments, they'll have what they consider to be normal child development categories, mm-hmm. 0 to 2, 3 to 5, 7 to 9, you know, and they'll just, and they'll list out Fairfax County, where I'm currently resident. Mm-hmm. They've got those lists. Schools typically have them. And so there's that some people go on. But then there's other people that say, well, no, wait a minute. You know, what was the intent? What was going on? What else has been happening? And so it gets very difficult to describe, like, when was a crime committed? Mm. So if it's two or three kids playing house in somebody's basement and they're all, you know, 4 and 5 years old, that's quite a bit different than if there was a 15-year-old and a 6-year-old and a 2-year-old. Mm-hmm. And the older child starts perpetrating things. So the context is so different. And so what's normal behavior, exploratory behavior? That's part of what makes this so complicated, and part of why my strong admonition is we need to do this with others. Mm-hmm. We should not be doing these things in a vacuum.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point that you mentioned about having those multi-layered, because I think it's very easy, as I said, I think before maybe churches wanted to handle it by themselves because maybe they felt capable enough to do it by themselves. But it sounds like as you were exploring this, that you saw that there was a need to have multiple voices speaking to the issue. And then who makes that final decision, right?
Exactly.
So what ended up happening, I guess, in your church, where did the people leave and did they come back, or how was that handled?
It's been a wide range of things. And if I could just circle back to one thing that you alluded to, and that is that, yeah, sometimes it's churches can be arrogant and think that they've got it all figured out. I think it's less and less, again, God's kindness, that hopefully mm-hmm. we're being more humble. Actually, sometimes though, there's a real fear from the parents to widen the circle. Because they don't want other people necessarily involved. They don't want their child to be labeled if it's the victim as being sort of damaged or something like that. Or again, going back to shame, hey, how could that have happened? How could you let that happen to your kid?
Mm-hmm.
Parents. So sometimes the parents in the situations that I've been involved in, they were actually the ones pressing to not go too fast on letting the authorities know, mm-hmm. or letting anybody know, because in their mind, they were thinking that A, it either wasn't as severe, or B, they just did not want to get the authorities involved.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's got a whole bunch of reasons. Well, why is that? Is it just because of shame, or is it because there might be something else hidden? That the authorities might come in and find out about. And so it gets very complex. So who makes the decision? That's a really, really important thing, because each state has mandatory reporting requirements. So in Virginia, I am not always considered a mandatory reporter, depending on how I received the information. If I received it in the context of a confession, for instance. And so there's been legislation saying that's crazy, that should never happen. But that becomes a complex issue. So do I have a moral responsibility to say something if I know? That's mm-hmm. another way. So who makes the decision becomes very complex. And that's, again, why getting trusted advisors and knowing those people in advance. So we, getting back to what we currently do, you know, we have good relationships with the local authorities. Mm-hmm. So if something ever happens, we just get on the phone and just say, hey, here's a scenario. How do you recommend that we handle this? Who would be some other professionals that you recommend that we get involved?
That's really good.
And what we've seen in terms of your question, sadly, the range of things, the victims' families, it's just very difficult for them to stay in the church long-term, mm-hmm. because the church and the community of God's people that they might've grown up with, it's so painful.
Mm-hmm.
They see a lot of the familiar people. And again, it so much depends on how many other people knew what was going on.
Mm-hmm. I almost imagine a split, you know, because when you, and depending on the size of the church too, that's another thing, you know, smaller churches, everyone knows everyone, you know, in bigger churches, it might be a little bit more difficult for others to find out about it. But I know that in smaller churches get very much, I'm going to take so-and-so's side, I'm going to take this side. And then you have a split of the church, and I can, potentially see that happening.
Yeah, so we were a larger church at the time when these things happened, probably 600 or 700 members, plus a lot of kids. It was a very child-friendly church, a lot of families with lots of kids. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that even the size and scope and where these things happened, because geographically we were pretty dispersed as well. But yes, you're exactly right. So, but if you're all in one small town, mm-hmm. and there's 75 people in the church, that it's just going to look a lot different, and how that gets handled is really important. But the thing that I'll just always try to emphasize, mm-hmm. never forget the victim.
Yeah.
It's so easy when all these other adult issues are being navigated, questions are being asked, people are wanting your input, not wanting your input, but yet you're having to make decisions. Do I tell people in the church? Do I not tell people in church? How many people in church should know? How do we protect other children? All these things are going on, and they're real and they're important, but it's so easy to forget that there's a child who's been victimized, who needs care and attention. And not that you're necessarily going to be the one to provide that all the time, mm-hmm. but are you ensuring that that child's being followed up with? Are you ensuring that if the family doesn't have money for counseling, that you're raising money so they can get counseling? They're going to need it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's things like that. So we've seen, there have been some kids that have been able to stay in the church and thrive and continue on. Sadly, some of these situations involve families that had other issues that were going on. And so they left for different reasons. And then honestly, some of them, it was just too hard to be here. And I completely understand that.
Very, very, very understandable. And church size definitely plays a huge role in that dynamic, as well as family members and close friends. I mean, those were just so many layers just thinking about it. So I know that a lot of that was God's wisdom and grace, as you mentioned, given to you guys throughout that time. Based on your experience and what you learned through your research, is, you know, how should churches approach this issue? Do pastors need to do maybe an educational session to help the congregation understand all the dynamics? That way everyone's on board. So, you know, just based on your experience and your research, what would you recommend for churches and pastors to do?
Yeah, it's a great question. And could I break it up into two parts? Like, what
Absolutely.
should they do if something actually happens?
Okay.
And then I'll say, what could they do to kind of create a culture in the church
Perfect.
That helps with this?
Because
I tried to address both those things in the work that I did. Let me just start with how should churches handle this when they become aware of what's going on? I cannot stress the need and the requirement for God-dependent humility. We need to go to God. We need to recognize we don't have all the answers. There needs to be a clear and evident humility and a dependence on God for what's going on. And so praying about this, getting others to pray about this without even necessarily knowing any of the details, but going to God and getting God's help and getting help with others. And so I've got a few things that I can say that, like, when an allegation is made, here be the steps that we will follow. We're going to adhere to all reporting requirements. The authorities are there for our good, Romans tells us. And so in order to be able to report, you need to know the rules. And so I would tell pastors, church leaders, children's ministry leaders, deacons and churches, like, do you actually know what the reporting requirements are for your state? Because it depends state by state. What are the reporting requirements? And if something does come to you and it's reportable, you must report immediately. You have to do that. And if you're not sure, err on the side of reporting or getting in dialogue with the authorities early, not late. Sometimes that can be a problem. Just even the fact that you would hesitate communicates something to the victim's family.
Yeah, you're right.
Do you not believe us? Do you think my kid's lying? The reality is very few reports, while they might not always be exactly accurate on every detail, they're usually almost always on target in terms of generally something happened here. So erring on the side of reporting early is the first one. I've already mentioned get help from others immediately. Multidimensional problems require multidimensional solutions. Law enforcement, child protective agencies, social workers, child psychologists, licensed professional counselors, medical doctors, psychiatrists. These are the kind of people you're going to, not that every situation requires a team that large, but those are some of the types of people you're going to want weighing in on this.
Yep.
So that you're not making this decision in a vacuum about how to handle this, how to care for people, how to move forward, what advice to give. Here's one of the things that happens. People trust their pastors and they say, well, what do you think I should do? Should I report this? Should I press charges against the other family? And all of a sudden you're like, I'm not a lawyer. I'm not, it's complicated. Another thing, immediately, you've got to be thinking in your head, how do we protect any other child from being victimized? Children in the home, children in the homes, other children, like, were there more kids involved in this? Like, you need to find that stuff out. And safety first, no more abuse. It's going to be hard enough to deal with the ramifications of what happened, but you don't want anything else to happen on your watch. Once you become aware of it, you need to make sure that there's protection for other children. You're going to need to wisely figure out how to mobilize other members so that the victims' families and the perpetrators' families can be cared for relationally, because while it might be very quickly apparent that the children need counseling, who's counseling the parents? And if money becomes an issue, well, of course they're going to pay for their child to get help, but who's helping mom and dad as they're crying themselves to sleep at night about what happened? Or they're just distraught over how could this be, or they're angry beyond belief and they want to go over and hurt somebody for what happened. So you're going to need to mobilize some people to care for them. You're going to need wise, godly people who've been well-equipped and trained to care with other people who are in crisis situations. Another quick thing is, you know, you need to think about what you're going to say to people outside of the immediate people who know what's going on. And that's where things get really hard. That's why you need a team of people. And then you need some practical things like a victim care plan for them and their family. A perpetrator care plan. We have to do that too. God wants us to care for those that are entrusted to our care. But how do you care for the church? How do you minimize gossip and slander? How do you make sure that we're equipping the church in terms of understanding repentance and what does that look like, and forgiveness. But forgiveness and trust are not the same things, you know. Mm-hmm. So there have to be things put in place to protect other children. And this is messy stuff. How do you, in an ongoing way, evaluate and adapt when you find out new information? One of the things that happens when children commit sins against each other, it doesn't usually all come out at once. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's a process, and you've got to be nimble enough to be able to say, look, here's our plan, but here's how we'll adjust if we find out things were much worse than we thought, mm-hmm. or maybe not as bad as we thought. And you have to be sensitive to the leading of the Spirit and the wisdom of the multitude of counselors that you have to help navigate that. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is keep good records.
That's great.
Because a lot of times people forget when they're in the midst of a crisis that they've asked you things or talked about stuff. And I can't tell you how helpful it is when you go back and say, hey, mm-hmm. remember a couple of weeks ago when we talked, and here were a couple of things we talked about. Are those still the things that are helpful to you, or would you like to talk about some different things? But for the victim's family, the perpetrator's family, it is so confusing. It is so disorienting that actually keeping good records can help them and serve them. So those are a few things when it actually does happen.
No, that is excellent. Excellent steps there, Vince. To speak to the point about the parents or just people involved in general, you know, one of the aspects of shame is hiding the painful memory, and that's for everyone, right? So no one wants to know that it's happening in their church. Parents don't want to know that it's happening in their children. The children don't want to know what's happening. They probably don't even understand what's happening. So there is that element of, do I want this to be part of my life? And shame represses that memory so much that it comes out later on, right? And this is part of the experience that I've had with counseling students and people who come in for counseling, is that they'll remember a specific song, they'll remember a specific touch, a specific situation, and they are go back to that moment and recall every single detail because it's so stored in their memory, but they choose to forget through all these years because of the shame. And then it comes up in the counseling office, and then that's where you have it present and you work through that. And it takes years sometimes to process all of that. But I think the way that the tips that you gave for churches and pastors to handle it is so instrumental and helpful. And guys, if you're listening, please take this information and use it and apply it in your churches and ministries, because I know a lot of you guys are involved in churches and involved in ministries. So just something to be aware of. We can also be very active in preventing these things, right? We don't just leave it up to the pastors and the leaders, but also us as members of the church protecting our own. So always being mindful of that. Vince, are there any things that parents, ministry leaders, pastors, that they can look for that will signify some sort of wrongdoing? Are there any signs that children display? I could think of a couple, but are there any signs that you saw in your research that show that something's off, that something's just not right, that needs to be addressed or asked about from the children?
Yeah, again, those are really well-documented and well-researched topics. And that was, I was so glad to see that that's out there. And I think parents need to be aware of these things, but it can be simple things like just the demeanor of a child. So maybe mm-hmm. you have a talkative child and all of a sudden they get really quiet. Mm-hmm. Or all of a sudden, maybe the child starts to wet the bed at night, mm. or maybe they start to lose their appetite, or maybe they start to overeat. It can be very subtle things, but just any subtle or not so subtle change. Maybe they start to get angry. Maybe they start to recoil. Maybe they used to be very affectionate, but now they don't want to be touched at all. And these are all things where you would want to start finding a way to draw that out of the child. And that doesn't mean that every time a child wets the bed that's you know, that's an evidence of something, but taken together, you want to look for some of these signs that did something happen here that was significant, that's being internalized by this child, that's having an outward manifestation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So anything that's out of the ordinary of how the child usually behaves. So yeah. Parents know their kids, right? Like, you know how your kid is. So anything that throws their usual character off or personality, just something to pay attention to and keeping record of that.
Well, yeah. And so here'd be an example. So all of a sudden you've got a nice young child and they're, you know, pretty compliant or, you know, whatever, just a normal kid. And all of a sudden they start talking about all this very sexually explicit stuff. And they start saying all these words around the house. You're like, hey, where did that come from?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it may have come from somebody's computer that got left open or some TV show that they listened to. It also could have come from some other kid in the neighborhood or some other church family's kid. And it could have come on a vacation. It could have been, where did that language come from? You want to find that out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so it can be, you know, just that type of behavior or that type of language, you know, those sorts of things would all be the types of signs to look for. And again, most state agencies, government agencies even, are really good about pretty short checklists. Most public schools have one. They usually get that in a welcome packet to families going to the school. Hey, here are signs of abuse to be on the lookout for. Those would be a few of the things.
I guess now the question is just left for the parents, you know, for parents who maybe I'm sure a lot of parents who are listening now are scared. They're wondering, you know, one of the hard things is that bringing up questions, because a lot of parents are going to start asking questions. Oh, I saw this. And, you know, they might go over the top, maybe on everything that they're seeing. You know, how do we find a balance? I know that's a hard question because, like, how do you find a balance? Every parent is different. Some parents are more watchful. Some parents are a little bit more, you know, let the kids do what they want type of thing. So what's your recommendation for parents in regards to both preventing and also dealing with it afterwards, if it does happen?
Yeah, and I appreciated that you highlighted the fact that it's a broad range of people. I mean, just look at our friend groups and just who we know and who our friends are. And depending on any situation, our friends will all act and react in different ways. They, even in marriages, husbands and wives. I mean, there's so many different things. So you're right to highlight the fact that, first of all, there's no cookie cutter to this.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we've got to go back to biblical maturity. Like, who are we in Christ? How is God's word forming us, shaping us, transforming us by the renewing of our minds so that we've got God's word, God's spirit leading us and guiding us through that so that as disciples of Christ, we walk together in community with other people. Mm-hmm. And so whether it's dealing with child-on-child abuse or somebody whose spouse had an affair with somebody else or some other terrible sin that, you know, happens, that in that sense, it's normal Christian behavior for how we walk together with each other in a broken world.
Mm-hmm.
And so parents don't have to be afraid. This isn't the worst thing ever. It's difficult, it's complex, and it is incredibly grievous. But there's also grace. Like Christ died for us and for our salvation, and he's reclaiming our lives and he's reclaiming this earth. And we have a confident hope in him. It's not going to leave us nor forsake us. And so we want to get our eyes upward. And as we walk through these situations, we want people around us who help us do that too. Mm-hmm. We need pastors who teach people about the hope that they have in the gospel and the help that comes from God through his spirit and by his word. And we want to be surrounded by people who are other mature believers who think that way too. Now, they also need to be kind and caring and comforting and loving, but not absent of the truth.
The truth
found in God's word. And there's a balance there, an important balance. And so I think as we help the whole array of parents deal with situations like this, you know, there's a couple things that I think are really important. And that is just reminding people, not with a fearful way, but reminding parents, hey, you're responsible for your children. So think about that when you're going over to so-and-so's house. Just not to be super high on alert. I'm going to question everybody. And because some people are tempted that way anyway. So what I say right now might be like, see, I told you I'm allowed to do this and I can assume that everybody is going to do something wrong. I'm like, no, that's not what I'm saying. That's not biblical maturity either. But we do need to make sure that parents remember, look, there's a responsibility that you have for the safety and protection of your children. And think about that in the different scenarios you're in. And so one of the ways that it's really helpful is learn how to talk to your children about sex and sexual activity, in an age-appropriate way. One of the mistakes that I've seen over the years is that parents thought, well, they're too young, I don't want to introduce any of those ideas. And I think that's unwise. I think there's some really good material out there. Justin Holcomb and his wife have written on this. They've written some kids' books that talk about touch and their bodies. And I think as they get older, you can talk in age-appropriate ways. And I would really make sure that the parents do that. It can be a little bit awkward. It can get some help. Find out from other people what they do. But it's really important, because if you've broached a topic with your kids and then something happens, they're going to be much more inclined to talk to you.
Yeah, vocabulary for it.
Exactly. And use real words. Don't just talk about, you know, make-believe words. Like, use real words that actually describe real activities and real body parts. That's an important thing, because if something does happen, there's a trust established with you that it's okay for them to talk with you about it. If they've never had that conversation with you and they're already dealing with guilt and shame, some of the research shows that the parents are not the ones who the children will talk to. They'll go talk to another friend or some other relative or somebody else, but they won't talk to the parents.
And so parents play a key role with that, huh?
Exactly. And in our God-given role, we need to think about how to make a safe harbor for our kids to be able to come talk to us about anything that happens, to where they know that they would only get love and grace from us and not guilt and shame.
We don't want to compound that for them.
And so another thing that parents can do is just be thinking through, what are the guidelines you want that are age appropriate when your children are interacting with other children, especially when you physically can't see them? Just a simple thing, but just, hey, if you're going to go over and have coffee at somebody's house and you say, hey, well, let's let the kids play in the backyard, that's fine. But does your child know what is and is not appropriate behavior if they're outside? Down in the basement or playing a make-believe game like house or something like that. Oh, we've got mommy and dad. Let's play mommy and daddy. Okay, well,
what does that mean?
What are the boundaries for that? What's off limits in terms of touch? You know, do the kids know that?
So you're saying for parents to specifically address what things can actually happen.
Exactly. And you can ease your way into these things. You know, it's just, again, that's where I think getting some of these books, like what the Holcombs have produced and things like that, so that these are just normal conversations and not the, okay, now we have to have the talk.
Right.
I think that's a big mistake. And, you know, like there's some of these books, oh, don't talk to them till they're 12. Don't talk to them till they're, you know, 15. I'm like, oh my goodness. Like, have no idea what may have already been happening. And not only that, but these are wonderful opportunities to talk with kids about how fearfully and wonderfully they're made by God. These are body image issues. These are like, God made us good that way. Now, a good thing can be made a bad thing if it's misused. And yeah, let's talk about that. But there's so much positive talk that can be done with children to set the table so that their little antennas will go up if something starts to be not right. And that's where just learning how to even follow up. Hey, how was your time over at so-and-so's house? Hey, when we were upstairs, how did it go? And here's a safe question. Hey, did anything happen that made you feel uncomfortable?
That's good. Yeah.
You're just being a mom. You're just being a dad. You're just talking with
your children. They share and they'll talk.
And sometimes it won't have any, most of the time it won't have anything to do with sexual sin, but maybe so-and-so used a bad word. And they were like, and that really troubled them and they feel really bad about that. And they feel guilty that they heard it. Okay. Well, you learn something, you know, but that's when we walk along the road with our kids and when they rise up and when we put them down to bed. It's a lifestyle of living with our kids in a conversation.
A presence, a strong presence. You know, you brought up a good point there, Vince, about addressing the issue. I remember one of the pieces of advice that my supervisor told me, they said, you know, when you're doing marriage counseling, do you talk about sex, the sexual relationship between them? And some people answered, I don't know if it doesn't come up. Is it? Nope, you have to go there. Because if you don't go there, they're not going to go there. And right. I think that same principle applies, is that a lot of the reason why some people don't go there is because they feel uncomfortable with the topic. So how do I get comfortable talking about this? Well, one is reading, right? Another one is actually having that conversation with other people like we're having right now. This is an uncomfortable topic, but we're talking about it. And we're helping people hopefully understand that it's okay to talk about these difficult issues because it's part of the church. And this is also a way for us to be aware and to learn how to address this very important topic. So same thing for parents. If you don't go there, your children are not going to just bring it up out of nowhere. You have to develop that presence and relationship with them where anything can go, you know?
Yeah. So let me circle back on that. So one of the reasons why I think parents can sometimes be hesitant to talk about this is let's go back to the statistics. If 1 in 4 women have been abused before they were 18 and 1 in 6 men have been abused, how do you think that might affect them wanting to talk about sexual behavior between children with their own children?
Wow. Yeah. It's powerful.
You know, there's a lot of people that I know that it's not until they're in their 40s or 50s mm-hmm. until they actually start to talk to somebody about what happened to them when they were a little girl or a little boy.
Mm.
And they live a whole lifetime of raising their children and they never go there.
Mm.
Why? Because they never went there and they never got the help that they needed. And so they've lived this whole life with this shame over them, and they just don't talk about it. And so I think the fact that this type of sin gets perpetrated generation after generation, I think actually plays a significant part on why it doesn't actually get talked about.
Yeah, you're right. Hmm.
And not only that, but then, and this is just, I don't have all the data to support all this, but I think intuitively you sit there and say, so if they don't want to talk about it because it's too hard for them to deal with in their own lives, and then they're projecting it onto their kids, what's the dynamic that's actually happening then between the kids and the parents?
Mm.
There's this whole gulf. There's this whole no-fly zone that happens between mom and dad.
So true. Yeah.
And it's so unhealthy.
Mm-hmm.
And so my advice would be to, if you're a parent and you have been abused, I just can't urge you enough. Please get the help that you need. Because if you don't get the help that you need, there's a likelihood that you're not going to be as effective as you would want to be with your own children, keeping them safe and helping them to navigate life in a broken world with the right tools in their toolbox to be able to say no to ungodly behavior, or God forbid, if something does happen to them, to know immediately what to do to get help.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really would urge any parent, young or old, if you've not dealt with issues in your own life, the chances are it's going to have an effect on the way that you're currently parenting your kids and equipping them for living in the world that God's called them to live in.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a great point, Vince. You know, and actually with clients that I've had, one of the things that they say about their parents is that I feel like mom knew, I feel like dad knew, and they just didn't talk to me about it. So I went through this time of just being confused by the whole situation. I had no one to talk to about it. So I think that touches on what you mentioned about parents dealing with that first, so that they can have a little more confidence in addressing those things and asking God for wisdom. I think you even address that as a pastor, as a church, just asking God for wisdom. This is not an easy thing to go through. It's not an easy thing to address. Just asking God for wisdom, you know, to the point about when you said that, people say start talking to them about sex at age 12 or 10 or whatever the case is. I mean, from a different aspect, kids are getting exposed to pornography at 5, 6 years old. I mean, this is early. So the sooner you can start talking about these things, the better you can address each of these topics as they get older, because those are very impactful topics and impactful situations. You know, the comfort that we develop around having those conversations, I think the point you made is essential.
Yeah, one of the illustrations that I heard years ago in a sermon that I've remembered all these years, and that is that, I hope it's true, that the way that they teach people how to know counterfeit bills, so mm-hmm. I can't remember what government agency it is that does that, they don't actually show them tons of different types of fakes. All they do is get them to study the original.
Hmm.
And they study the original and study the original, and they know every aspect of it. Hmm. And it's by studying the original that they know how to detect a fraud immediately.
Hmm.
And I think that's a really great parenting strategy too. Let's teach the kids the original. Teach them what they should know. Let's teach them the right way to think about God and how they're made and who they are relationally and as social beings and as physical beings.
Mm-hmm.
And let's teach them that so that when the inauthentic comes in, they know immediately that it's wrong.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's great. Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, Vince, this has been a very, very heavy and important topic, and I really appreciate your insight and expertise on this topic. I know with humility and guidance from God, you know, I think he's ordained this session, this interview, because I think a lot of people are going to be blessed by it, maybe scared, maybe insecure, maybe anxious, right? It might even trigger something for them. But guys, as you guys are listening, as we've mentioned, just make sure you do seek help if this has been something you struggled with, because I see it all the time. I'm sure Vince has seen it all the time as well. And this is an important area, because with children, you sometimes don't see it until way later down the line when they start coming to counseling and then you start addressing that. But if we can prevent this from happening as a body of Christ and being there for each other, you know, bearing one another's burdens, both, and your point about not forgetting the victim, right? And making sure that we address everyone and are able to help everyone at that time is so important. Pastors, ministry leaders, parents, everyone. I hope you have enjoyed this episode and were able to glean something from it. And I think, Vince, I think you're on board with this. We'll probably have a part two, because there's so much to unpack here.
If I can serve in any way, I'd be glad to. It's a really important topic, and it's important for us as Christians to do this together.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Vince, I appreciate you, sir. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Guys, if you haven't done so already, please subscribe to the show and you'll get updates for each new episode. And hopefully we'll continue this conversation soon. Have a good one, guys. Thank you, Vince.
Thank you.